Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, ooby-doo, I want to be like you, ooh-ooh. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Hey, everybody.
Yes, hey, Joe.
I have a question for you.
Ask away.
Let's say you were going to put your life in the hands of a particular technology. Let's say it's some kind of biomedical device that you need to save your life, or maybe it's some kind of vehicle that if it fails, you're going to have a lot of trouble. But this device doesn't exist yet. You need to create it, okay?
Wow, okay.
No pressure, though.
And you've got two choices. Would you rather have one really smart scientist and one really smart engineer with about 6 months to work on it and a six-figure budget? Or would you rather have millions of really, really bad scientists with 4.5 billion years to work on it and pretty much infinite resources?
So what you're telling me is that we're not exactly at emergency status.
Not exactly. Since
in theory we have 4.5 billion.
Yeah.
I'm going with the 4.5 billion years approach because I don't think I'd live that long even without whatever life-threatening situation happens to be pointing
well,
in my
Let's just say what if.
Oh, all right, fine.
You've uploaded your consciousness to the Matrix, and then 4.5 billion years later, they're going to put the hard drive that your brain is stored on this vehicle that's going to fly through the sky. Would you rather have this vehicle designed by...
What if... All right, so...
The limited but talented humans... Or the completely brainless but amazingly well-supplied other.
I think I see where you're going with this. And while many of us, I think, credit amazing geniuses for the innovations that make our lives convenient and safe and healthy, we can't ignore the fact that many of those innovations come to us courtesy of the fact that nature has had billions of years to try out different designs, not consciously, I want to make that clear, but all these different approaches have come around in life, and the ones that have worked the best have stuck around, so nature's gotten great at perfecting certain types of approaches. So I go with the 4.5 billion years dumb approach.
Yeah. You saw through my analogy. Lauren, would you?
Also, I have the notes here. It's good.
Yeah, I it's a really hard question to answer when I already know the topic that we're discussing today.
I apologize.
It's
too transparent to y'all. Okay, well, my analogy, of course, is that the millions of dumb scientists with nearly infinite time and resources is the process of biological evolution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is a decently good one.
Yeah, doesn't have very good foresight or any foresight.
Right.
Doesn't have very good top-down control or any top-down control necessarily.
Right.
But it does have a lot of time and a lot of resources to work things out.
And right. It can produce some really amazingly useful things and some very specialized things.
Yeah, things that if we wanted to try and create something technological that would give us an advantage in some way or make our lives better in some way or just achieve a certain type of task, often it behooves us to take a look at nature and see if there are any examples in the natural world where this already exists and then say, how can we do that same thing?
That's actually something that scientists and engineers do all the time.
Yeah.
It's this field known as biomimetics or biomimicry. And Jonathan recently did a video about biomimetics where he talked about some really interesting topics
in
this field.
To be fair, I was copying an ant that had previously done a video. So I was biomimicking.
Really, all we ever do is copy ants.
That's true. Not the organism. We're talking about the actual DreamWorks motion picture ants, A-N-T-Z.
Oh, I was thinking about my ants. I mean, like Linda and
oh,
Kathy
like your aunts.
And Sandy.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah. Right.
They're really cool.
And they are living organisms. So if you were to invent technology based on them, that would be biomimetics.
We get loopier every episode. I'm not sure what's causing it. But no, this is actually a really awesome topic, just in general. And we so awesome that we want to cover it in a pair of podcasts. So this one, we're like looking at a very kind of general approach to biomimetics, but we've got another one that's much more focused on a particular organism. But for this, we thought we'd talk about lots of different examples that you can find of cutting edge technology that is taking its inspiration from stuff that's existed in some cases for billions of years.
Including some of the ones that you went into in your video, because mm-hmm. we wanted to sort of break those out and really explain the weird nitty-gritty bits of how it's working. The first topic that we wanted to cover was how moths' eyes have inspired better solar panels.
Okay, now, I talked about it in the video, but this seems counterintuitive at first. So, Lauren, why don't you kind of walk us through what is it that's special about a moth's eyes?
Oh, well, let's back it up. But before that, you know, we've spent a lot of time on this show talking about how solar panels are pretty inefficient,
sure.
right? As they stand, the best ones in the field are really only using some 25% of the light hitting them. Part of the problem being that each of the many layers of photovoltaic material that make up solar panels reflects a little bit of light, meaning that light that's reflecting can't be used to generate electricity, meaning that you're wasting potential.
Right. It's like it's reflecting out of the solar panel, so you're not capturing it.
Right.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you wanted to heat up your body as much as possible, you wouldn't want to wear bright colors that reflected all of the light off of you.
Or leave large parts of your body uncovered.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be very effective either.
Or coat yourself in mirrors.
Wow. Well, you are ruining my plans for the weekend. All right. So getting to the moth size, what's so special about those?
It turns out that they are really non-reflective, which is really useful to nocturnal animals, which moths are. You know, they do their thing at night. And it means that they can see in really low lighting situations because lots of light gets through to the nerves in their eyes that you know, work with their brains to sense light.
It also helps in camouflage in the sense that they're reflecting
right.
less light so predators can't see them. But really, we're focusing, not to make too big a pun, on the fact that it's redirecting light into the eye itself.
Mm-hmm. And they have two structures in their eyes that help them out with this. First, they have a tapetal mirror, which is a lens at the back of their eyes that bounces light back through the eyeball for a second chance at hitting all of those sensor nerves.
Wow.
It's also why like shark eyes and cat eyes seem to glow in the dark.
Also alligator eyes.
Yeah. Lots of animals have
creepy.
This thing.
Yeah.
And they've also got a special structure called, and okay, this is for reals the technical term, you guys.
Hit me.
A corneal nipple array.
We can't say that on this podcast.
This is science.
Okay, fair enough.
And it's this nanoscopic landscape of cone-shaped structures, each only some like 200 to 300 nanometers tall and wide.
Wow. And remember, a nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. These are tiny, tiny structures.
Yeah. And these wee little things allow light to just kind of slip by. The shape doesn't reflect light the way that a flat surface would. Researchers started taking note of this all the way back in the 1970s.
Wow. All right. Okay. So we see these little structures. We see that they are allowing light to slip through and not reflect off. But that doesn't necessarily mean there's a practical application right away. But someone managed to find one, right?
Yeah. Researchers, and you talked about them a little bit in detail in the video, at the North Carolina State University recreated the nanostructure. And started putting it into photovoltaic materials. So the exact amount of light that's regained by the structures in photovoltaics is unconfirmed at the moment, but it's really cool that scientists are working on it.
Right. So this is a promising technology. We do not yet know if its efficacy is such that it's going to be a good return on investment. It may turn out that the expense of engineering this doesn't really justify whatever increase in efficiency we might see, or it may turn out that it ends up boosting efficiency enough where this becomes the
norm.
The norm, exactly.
Yeah. One of those early problems that we've run into is that the nanostructures get really easily clogged with dirt.
Mm.
I mean, they're little pokey things, and so dirt can just kind of sidle up in there and get stuck. But
right.
But some researchers at the University of Cambridge are working on creating self-cleaning materials that have this desired nanostructure, which involves like photocatalytic nanoparticles of titanium dioxide that break dirt down into just carbon dioxide and water.
Of course.
I mean, that's what I would have done.
Well, the cool thing here is, I mean, since they get clogged with dirt, that would obviously mean that you are making the solar panel more sort of, well, the
opaque.
The level in front of the photovoltaics gets opaque, and so no light is getting through. So yeah, obviously this is a very important part. It's pretty cool. We've talked about self-cleaning materials a couple times too, so I'm glad that we were able to incorporate that in this discussion. Clearly, I wasn't able to go into that kind of detail in the video, so it's really neat to be able to get a chance to express it here.
So one of those other topics that you talked about in the video was the centripetal spiral in Nautilus shells and how they can be useful in fluid dynamics. And okay, so the gig with this guy's, turbines, which are just rotating devices that include a rod with blades attached to either move a fluid or to have a fluid move through the machine, thus generating work. Turbines have existed for a few thousand years in the form of water wheels and windmills. Yes. And there have been a lot of modern advancements to these, from the materials used to make them to very precise fluid dynamic driven physical tweaks. But they're still not perfect despite the best of our science, because they involve necessary resistance due to drag, a lot of noise, and continual wear to their components. And this is important research because although the turbines that we have today work pretty well, we've got a lot of things that would benefit from moving more smoothly through fluid, like, you know, cars or airplanes.
Yeah. Atmosphere is a fluid. So having that sort of smooth movement through a fluid, studying fluid dynamics, I mean, this is a complex field that concerns a lot of different sciences and also engineers.
Yeah, and if you have a more efficiently moving car, then you don't have to use as much fuel power it.
Yeah, there are multiple benefits that spill out by this kind of study.
One, Jay Harmon, who's the CEO of an industrial fluid dynamics design company called PAX Scientific, has patented a few designs based not on the age-old turbine design, but rather on the golden spiral, a.k.a. a logarithmic curve with a growth factor of phi, or a Fibonacci spiral, or the shape of a nautilus shell.
Huh. Yeah, as it turns out, you can look around in nature, and that shape pops up in more than just nautilus shells, right?
Everywhere, yeah. Basically. It's this really efficient, like, sturdy, space-saving shape. Lots of roses have petals arranged in this spiral. Sunflower seeds grow in the same pattern. Pine cones and pineapples have their spines arranged in, like, double phi spirals, mm-hmm. both clockwise and counterclockwise. The human inner ear is a golden spiral. Whirlpools are this golden spiral.
Yeah. So when you see the shape appear over and over again,
you're probably in the movie Uzumaki and you should watch out.
Or.
Sorry, that's kind of a nonsensical Japanese horror film. I don't necessarily recommend it.
The interesting thing I find about the shape, about seeing it over and over again, is that this is a suggestion that this particular shape has worked well for its numerous applications, depending upon what it is you're looking at. The fact that you're seeing it and not a bunch of different types of spirals. If you see one type of spiral happening repeatedly, that might be an indication that something's going on there that merits further study, that perhaps there are ways of taking advantage of said shape.
Harmon maintains that creating things that either move fluid or move through a fluid in this shape will make them just hella efficient. really, that is the technical science term.
That's true.
That it will reduce drag to not very much drag at all. He claims that it's the shape of, like, least resistance, conserving the most possible energy. And the idea here is that the shape enacts a centripetal force on the fluid, and I'm not a fluid dynamics expert, but I'm going to attempt to explain how this goes. So,
all right.
Okay. So letting fluid flow through this spiral shape means that the fluid molecules along the edges of the surface will experience drag, but creating what's known as a boundary layer of slow-moving fluid at the edges of the shape, which lets the rest of the fluid flow through the center of the shape faster, thus creating a vortex that kind of pulls the fluid through the shape.
Good Lord. The fact that you have fluid through and flow so many times in that explanation and you managed to get through it blows my mind.
I was speaking like five times as slow as I usually do, I think.
Flow flings fluids down by the flow shore.
Yeah. It's, but no, that's really cool. And, you know, it's, again, this is one of those things that you would have to test repeatedly to see if the effects are in fact measurable. But
sure.
But it is one of those things that on a given level seems to make real sense. So this spiral is fascinating, but there are also other examples of biomimicry, including the amazing gecko. I talked about this in the video, and I talked about how I love geckos. That is totally true. I love I think they're the cutest things, and I've been fortunate enough to visit Hawaii a few times. Hawaii, often, if you are staying in a home in Hawaii, which is normally where I stay, I've got a friend who lives there. A lot of those homes are kind of a gecko palaces. And so you'll wake up and you'll just see geckos on your wall and on your ceiling. And occasionally you need to shake out your clothes just to make sure that you're not going to have a gecko surprise when you put them on.
Do they bite?
No. Most,
they can.
They could bite.
I mean, they could really nip. I mean, they're not, their jaws are pretty small.
And they tend to, they are very timid critters.
Yeah,
they run
shy.
Away. They don't, they are not the kind that want to come up to you. Yeah. No.
But as you talked about in the video, and as I think we've alluded to briefly on this podcast before, geckos have some amazing feet.
Yes. They are able to crawl up vertical surfaces. They're able to crawl across ceilings. They're able to hang by a single toe from a pane of glass.
Yeah. So if you wanted to recreate this in the lab, how would you go about doing that? Well, you could think maybe, oh, maybe I need to put some kind of really sticky material like glue on my hands.
Or maybe suction cups, like giant suction cups. That's got to be how they
that
do it,
right?
That
works really well in comic books.
Yeah.
But the thing
from
is,
the 1960s.
Yeah.
These types of things aren't really very feasible, especially in the long term. If you've got some kind of sticky residue like a glue, that's not going to stick to some types of surfaces, well, yeah, right?
There are multiple problems. One, it's not going to stick to everything. Two, it's not necessarily going to be easy for you to remove your hand and then move it to the next space.
Yeah.
And three, it'll eventually wear off if you don't have some way of secreting said sticky substance.
So how do they do it?
Well, they don't do it through a sticky substance, do they? They do it through hair,
through
y'all.
Nanotechnology.
Yes, they do, actually.
Researchers studying geckos found out that they have nanoscale beta-keratin elastic hairs on their feet and toes. And let me break that down for you, just in case you that doesn't really mean a whole lot to you in that particular configuration of words. They're very strong, very thin protein structures. Beta-keratins are what make up like reptiles' scales and claws and shells, and also birds' feathers, beaks, and claws. They've got about the same toughness of chitin, which makes up sea bug shells, you know, lobsters and crabs and all that kind of stuff. But they can be really stretchy and bendy, especially at the nanoscale, in which, as we have spoken about before, everything is super wiggy.
Yeah, yeah. Things on the nanoscale have, they behave in different ways than stuff that we're used to on the macro scale. So when you get down to the nanoscale, you're actually getting small enough where quantum effects start to take place too, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, so, but wait a second. I can stick my head, which is covered in hair, if you can't see it right now, against a wall, and that does not help me stick to the wall. So how are these little hair-like fibers helping?
Well, first of all, the human hair is, you know, some 100,000 nanometers thick, so it's not nearly on the same scale.
These wee little hairs are so wee that they interact on a molecular level with the stuff that, that walls or glass or whatever are made of.
Yeah.
What's called the van der Waals force kicks in, and wham, the critter can climb right up something.
I love Oasis's song about that. You're my van der Waals. What? It was just me? Well, all joking aside, or at least most of it aside, van der Waals force, this is something that can be either an attractive force or a repulsive force. It's not necessarily one or the, it's not just attraction, but this is something we talk about on a molecular level with surfaces and their tendency to either adhere or repulse.
So a few different research teams have been working on replicating this in materials. There's a team particularly from the Zoological Institute at the University of Kiel that created a silicone tape that's patterned with tiny hairs. No glue, no residue, works underwater. It can be peeled off and restuck to things thousands of times without losing its gripping power.
See, I want to have one of those toys that you used to have where you could throw it against the wall.
Yeah.
And it would very slowly crawl down using mm-hmm. this kind of approach. And you could just throw it against the wall or a window or anything, and it just splats and stays there. I would have fun with that.
That would be minutes of good fun.
Okay. For you, Lauren, minutes of good fun. However, I'm a simple human being and could easily stretch that into a full afternoon of activities. So.
Oh, and part of the thing here is that these hairs aren't the only things that geckos have going for them in terms of sticking capacity. Their wall climbing ability also involves the curved shape of their toes and the way that their feet and toes spread out when they make contact with the surface, and their toes' self-cleaning abilities.
Self-cleaning. Now, this is kind of going back to what we had the discussion about the little projections and the moth eye projections, that when we made the synthetic versions, we had to come up with some sort of self-cleaning process in order to make the solar panels not get all clogged up and opaque. So what's going on here?
Well, our friendly neighborhood creepy crawly researchers at the University of Akron, and I do want to mention, you pronounced it in the video, Akron.
Yeah.
And
no, I noticed,
that was a thing that happened.
To be fair.
He was talking about the planet.
To be fair.
Akron.
That only happened in one take. And Dan chose that take.
I was born in Akron, so I needed to point it out.
I understand.
I have Ohio State pride.
I watched that video recently, as in just before we went into this podcast, and I winced when I realized that was the take he went with.
At any rate, we've mentioned these researchers a couple times recently, I think, and they published some research about geckos' footprints that has helped us kind of solve this puzzle a little bit further. It turns out the gecko footprints contain residue of these thin oils called phospholipids, which we're pretty sure geckos excrete to keep all those little nano hairs clean. And it might also help them quickly adhere to and release from surfaces.
Right. So that would make sense. You would want to keep the hairs clear of any debris, because otherwise that would it would inhibit your
that vulnerable rolls. Yeah.
Exactly. You wouldn't mm-hmm. be able to adhere to the wall anymore. And also, yeah, the oil making it easier to release and then put your foot down and then release again in order to continue motion. Again, it makes sense. Obviously, these are things that are under continuing study. So it seems to be a solid hypothesis. We'll see if it after we're able to study it further, if it holds true.
Yeah. And once we get that figured out, it might help some of these other physical process researchers to perfect the designs that they're making. Like in addition to that silicone tape, some other researchers are working with carbon nanotubes to reproduce the physical structures of these little hairs.
Man, carbon nanotubes, what can't they do?
They are magic.
They are.
They're,
well, not really, but they seem like it.
No, really, magic.
Thanks, Joe.
They're made by wizards. the most success that these researchers have seen so far has been with vertically aligned, single-walled carbon nanotubes, in case you were curious, and I know you were.
Of course.
Which could hypothetically have a greater maximum sticking power than the original gecko feet themselves.
That's pretty awesome. I have heard of people determined to make kind of a wall climbing suit using essentially this approach, using carbon nanotubes as the gripping power for that kind of suit. So essentially this is a different sort of spidey suit. We've talked about other ones, like we talked about the spidey suit that gives you an alert if there's an oncoming object.
Uh-huh.
But in this case, it would be a totally different type of spidey suit that would allow you to climb walls. I guess you could incorporate both so that you could finally get a Spider-Man outfit going.
Well, you still wouldn't have the webs.
No, but stay tuned for Digging Fans, because we might actually address some of that in a future podcast.
You know, but there are a lot of other ways that biomimicry can come into the way we create new pieces of technology, and especially in robotics.
That's a huge one. And we've talked about that in the past, too.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to say about robotics is that you can look to biomimicry or biomimetics not just to inspire the physical designs, like, okay, so we can make something like Gecko Feed.
The materials, right.
Yeah, not just the materials, not just the static designs, but you can use biomimetics to program behavior.
That's true.
And what I had in mind was the Boston Dynamics robots that we've talked about
right.
before.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, like Big Dog.
Yeah, Big Dog or the Wildcat, you know,
yeah.
these running four-legged robots, or they also have bipedal robots,
yes.
walking two-legged robots. It's interesting that when you look at robots, most of them, if they're going to be moving around, they have tracks or they have wheels.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Legs are tough.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wheels are very energy efficient. They're great. They're easy to program. But
they're
legs,
not good for everything.
Right. We have legs for a reason. We can do all kinds of stuff that most robots can't do. We can climb trees. We can scrabble over weird-shaped rocks. We can
use them to help propel us for swimming.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different
they're
ways of
locomotion. They're very, very versatile in a way that wheels are not. Not at all. And so it's not just the fact that we're making robots that have legs that's biomimetic, but it's also the way that we program legs. I mean, when you think about this, say you're programming a robot to move around. Well, if it just has wheels, that's pretty simple. You can say roll this way to go forward, roll this way to go back, you know, turn with this differential and in the different wheels to go one way or the other.
Right.
But if you've got legs,
yeah, depending upon how many
do you do?
Means you have to take into account the freedom of movement. How many points of freedom of movement do those legs have?
Mm-hmm.
What is the weight of the robot? What's the momentum the robot's going to be experiencing?
How to balance the weight on each of the four legs as they're moving?
Right, yeah.
Or however many legs?
Because if you have four legs on a robot, I mean, it's not obvious at what time each leg should move.
Right. Yeah, know? So there's a lot of biomimicry that goes on in the robotics field, a lot of study of how animals move and then attempting to engineer that so that a robot can take advantage of this particular approach. I mean, we've seen it in nature, how animals are able to maneuver adeptly through an environment. And if we're able to copy that, then that's a lot easier than just trying to innovate, you know, from nothing.
Yeah. One of my favorite biomimetic designs that I've seen in robot locomotion is something we've talked about on this mm-hmm. podcast before. It's the way the Boston Dynamics Big Dog robot stumbles.
Yeah.
It stumbles to catch itself when it's been knocked off balance.
Right. If it were to step, say, on an unsteady rock and the rock gave way, it would be able to stumble and catch itself.
To shift its weight around.
Right.
Yeah. In a way that looks really unnervingly realistic.
Right.
Yeah.
Or if someone who perhaps, when you're watching a video, appears to be an uncaring sociopath kicks the dog, it can catch itself. I realize
I'm still upset by that.
This human being is probably someone who has a rich emotional life and
would never kick a real
dog.
Would
never kick a real animal, but it's just that it's
and
that,
would probably never kick the robot unless for strict testing purposes.
Right. It was just one of those reactions where you immediately think, you are a bad person. They're not a bad person. It's just that's the reaction I had immediately upon watching the video of someone kicking this dog, which not dog, but this robot. Which then would catch itself. I had another one, which I had to include, which was the Velociroach.
Oh, yeah. I've read about this one.
This was one of those robots that as soon as you read about, you think science, there are some things you can do and some things you should do. And those two things do not always coincide. Why have you created a robotic cockroach?
It's the classic Ian Malcolm question. You know, your scientists were so concerned with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Man.
Thanks, Ian Malcolm.
there's going to be a point where we're just going to do an entire podcast doing our own impressions of various celebrities. And we get
as
to,
scientists
I mean,
in
obviously
kind of silly
Nick Cage is going to be one of the three. I mean, that's going to have to happen.
Oh, you guys have already been treated to Noel's excellent Nicolas Cage.
Right.
Go back and listen to our podcast about bees.
I'm going to go ahead and call Jay Moore doing an impression of Christopher Walken because my impression of Christopher Walken is so bad I have to remove it at least by one impressionist.
Uh-huh.
At any rate, so the Velociraptor, getting back on track, is a robot that mimics the movement and body size of a cockroach. They took the cockroach as sort of the inspiration for the design of the robot. And for its size, it's one of the fastest robots for its size. You know, you have to take the scale into consideration. Also, you can just see it in lots of different other examples in robotics. These are just a couple of the ones that we thought would be fun to talk about, but it's throughout the entire industry. Beyond that, we're looking at biomimicry for things not just technology related, but sort of on a civil engineering and social engineering level. Social insects have become an area of study for that reason, because social insects, if you were to look at an individual insect that has this kind of social structure, so something like an ant or a bee, now that particular example, that particular individual insect, its behaviors are pretty simple.
Yeah, it's not really what we would call smart.
Yeah, it's not at all smart. It's pretty dumb in the big grand scheme of things. However, the collection of these insects can behave in very complex and seemingly intelligent ways and respond to dynamic changes in its environment in a very impressive approach. And that kind of thing fascinates scientists and engineers and could potentially let us answer some questions that could end up benefiting humans down the line.
I would argue that bees are probably more smart than ants, but maybe only because I know bees better.
Right.
Maybe we should do a Future of Ants podcast.
Yeah. We'll wait till he's out of town.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed, we do insect podcasts
while I'm gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fair. Just don't do the same with arachnids, okay? Make that promise for me.
We promise, Jonathan.
No problem.
All right. Okay, good. It's an easy promise to make because we already did that one. But anyway, so let's talk about beetles.
Beetles.
Yeah. Let's do talk about beetles.
Not the not, band.
Hey, we're the Beetles.
Not the band.
People say we beetle around.
Wow. So you took a band that itself was essentially a weak copy of another band.
But they're a biomimetic band.
That's, you know what? That's fair. I am going to allow it. All right. No, I'm talking about beetles and irrigation, not irrigating your beetle.
So B-E-E-T-L-E.
Yes.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Not beetle, but beetle. So in this case, I'm talking about an engineer who looked at the Namib beetle and was inspired to create a way of extracting water from the air. See, this particular beetle, it tends to live in very arid conditions. And one of the things it does is that it'll come out onto the surface of whatever its environment is in the early morning and will allows water to collect on its shell. It condenses upon its shell, and then it uses that water to help survive.
Huh.
So
okay.
This engineer looked at that and said, is there something I could do that kind of mimics this sort of behavior? And he came up with a system that had a self-powered pump and a series of tubes, not unlike the internet. No, wait, I'm sorry. That's not really a series of tubes. No, there really was a series of tubes underground that pumped cool air to this above ground portion of the device. Yeah, it's called the airdrop. So the above ground portion of the airdrop gets cooled by this air that's flowing through these underground pipes. And that cooling means that water will condense on the airdrop and then flow down into a collection area.
Huh.
And specifically, this would be used to collect water to then give over to a garden. It's not a lot of water. You would not imagine it to be a lot of water. This is for arid locations where you're pulling tiny amounts of moisture out of the air. But it can be enough to grow certain types of plants. So it's a really interesting approach. And it also won an award. I think he got something like $10,000. To continue to develop the idea. And there are a lot of countries that are particularly interested in looking at this approach, seeing if it's scalable, seeing if it's a practical approach. So it's really interesting as well.
Yeah, definitely. One of the other things that we wanted to talk about was a suggestion from one of our YouTube viewers on the video that you, Jonathan, did about biomimetics. And this was user Magic of Dark.
Right.
So thank you, sir or madam, for writing in.
So Magic of Dark, here is the scenario I'm going to paint for you. I'm not going to say immediately what it was you requested. It'll become apparent. But way back in 1941, Georges de Mestral went for a walk. Now, this guy is a Swiss engineer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. He's going out there. He's walking.
He's looking for new and exciting ways to make hot chocolate.
Yeah. You know, the way Swiss engineers do. And eventually gets back after the end of his walk and starts to do what any self-respecting walking naturalist slash engineer would do, which is start to pick the burrs that have accumulated on clothing and his dog out of the various fabrics and hairs.
If you have a longer haired dog, picking burrs off the dog is a sad and very labor intensive process.
Yes, it's much easier just to take scissors to the dog.
Aww.
What? The dog doesn't know.
My dog is a hairy dog, and he gets burrs all in his face.
Aww.
Yeah.
It's so sad.
I have had to deal with this, but my dog tends to get them stuck in his paws. So Aww. It's also, yeah, there's a lot of sadness. But no, this is not a sad story, guys. This is a story about how the Swiss engineer looked at these burrs and how they had hooked into his clothing and said, wait, is there a way that I could engineer a fabric that could do the same thing and act as a fastener? Because here I'm seeing a natural substance that's doing this. Could we do this so that it's on purpose? And so he created a pair of fabrics that complemented one another. One of those fabrics had lots of tiny hooks in it. The other fabric had lots of tiny hoops in it so that the hooks and the hoops would interlock when you put them together. And if you pulled them apart, they could snap loose, and thus Velcro was born.
Ah.
Now, Velcro is named after a combination of the words velvet and crochet. If you crochet, you use a little hook.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he wouldn't patent it until 1955. Of course, back in 1941, there was a little thing called World War II that was going on. So that was
keeping people busy.
People really busy. And the original Velcro was made from cotton. Now, eventually, Mistral would switch over to nylon because cotton would wear out after you used it for a while. And nylon was a little more resilient. And it ended up getting an enormous PR boost during the 1960s, because that's when the space race was in full effect. And one of the problems that NASA had was, hey, you know, if we go out to space, we're in free fall. So we're in this environment where there's weightlessness or very, you know, microgravity is in play. So how do we keep the stuff what we bring someplace where it's not going to get in the way? And they came up with, hey, why don't we use this Velcro stuff? It's easier than tying, especially if you're wearing a spacesuit. You know, you don't have the manual dexterity to necessarily tie something to something else. And it ended up being kind of a miracle technology for use during the space race. It was not invented specifically for that. That often ends up being one of those facts you'll hear. Things like, you know, 10 technologies NASA invented. It was invented before the space race, but it was incredibly useful during the space race. And as a result of that, it ended up becoming well known, so much so that the term Velcro is now used for any sort of materials where it has this hook and loop system.
Yeah.
Not all of those are technically from the company Velcro.
It's proprietary, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
But it's sort of
like Frisbee or Xerox.
Or Kleenex or Band-Aids, you know, the sort of thing where one example, the primary example, becomes the name for all of the product. It's sort of similar, Jell-O, same sort of thing. So anyway, that's the story. It's pretty cool.
It was a big success, and of course we all know now that it went on to forever replace all shoelaces.
I did have Velcro sneakers when I was a kid.
In the 80s, early 90s?
Yeah.
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 I also had hypercolor t-shirts, but that's not biomimicry. That's just awesome.
I think that in fashion, all buttons, laces, and buckles of all kinds should be replaced by Velcro.
I really dislike Velcro on my clothing. I hate the noise. I can't stand the noise.
I also think all pants should have elastic ankles.
I don't like you anymore.
I have so many jokes, but none of them are appropriate, so I'm going to move on. The last thing I was really going to look at, and by look at, I mean just talk about, because you can't really look at it, is nanotechnology. Again, we
have to have a really good microscope.
Yeah, and even then, if you're talking about an optical microscope, you can't really look at it, because if you're at a small enough scale, you're actually so small that light itself is not going to pick you up. So anyway, nanotechnology has become a growing industry in the world of science and tech, and a lot of that is all about biomimicry, because as it turns out, building stuff on the nanoscale is really hard. Like I mentioned, we have quantum effects that can come into play there. And it is difficult even for us to be able to see, let alone manipulate things down at that scale.
Well, when we've talked about molecular assemblers on this show before, you know, that's this idea that that you'd have this kind of almost magic machine that could, on the nanoscale, build tiny, tiny little components and, you know, make food or make pieces for your starship. It would just build everything molecule by molecule. Well, if that's ever possible in real life, it seems like it's a long way away. I mean, that's just, it's so hard to imagine making something like that. But your body has stuff in it right now that pretty much does that.
You are doing that as we speak.
Yeah, the ribosomes in your cells are basically molecular assemblers.
Right.
They're assembling molecules piece at a time.
And then you have things like viruses, which one of those things that's really difficult to classify. I mean, you still have those classic arguments of does a virus count as life or not, because it exhibits many of the traits of life, but not necessarily all of them. And it is an incredibly simple structure. But this simple structure, which is essentially you got a protein shell,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got the virus that's inside the shell, and the protein shell will dock with certain types of cells, which then allows the virus to invade the cell and essentially take over the cell's production facilities to make more viruses, which then can spread out and do the same to other cells. Well, there could be some actual practical uses of this in our world that are not involved with making someone sick. It could be making someone better. And the idea is to use something like a virus shell that would have the right proteins on it to dock with certain types of cells, specifically cancer cells.
Mm-hmm.
And then you scoop out whatever the viral material would have been inside this virus shell. And inside you put chemotherapy drugs. So you can deliver chemotherapy drugs to specific cells as opposed to a region. And in theory, you would be able to deliver an effective medicine while limiting the side effects as much as is possible.
Right, because one of the problems with a widespread chemotherapy is that it's going to make you very sick because it's getting into the poisons are getting into your other tissues, and that's bad times for you.
Yeah, it's
if you can target specifically the cancer cells, then
You really minimize that area effect that you get otherwise. So it's a really promising area of research. It's obviously incredibly complex. It's not, the idea is simple. The execution is much more difficult. But it's something that a lot of people are looking into. And I got a chance a few years ago to interview a nanotechnology expert at Emory. And he was talking about how using viruses was one of the most promising approaches, because why invent something that needs to do a specific task if there's already an example of it out in nature, which is exactly what we've been talking about this whole podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's the nanotechnology world is relatively new to us and strange and unusual, but in nature, this has been part of the way things work for billions of years. So we should look to examples, because that will be at least a first step into that world. And, we'll probably create new approaches that are built on those first steps that go beyond what nature does, but it's a good starting point. So yeah, pretty cool stuff. And there are probably thousands of other examples of biomimicry that we could talk about.
Tens of thousands.
Yeah. So
billions of thousands.
All right. Well, let's not go overboard. So, but if we happen to have accidentally skipped over one that you, dear listener, hold as the most important example of biomimicry, and you think, why didn't you talk about this? Let us know, because we'd love to be able to cover that perhaps in a future episode. Little word though, if it's about spiders, you can hold off.
Yeah, hold back that message.
And then if we didn't talk about spiders the way you wanted us to, then you can let us know. But really, if there are other examples that you think, no, this is super cool and people need to know about it, let us know. And the best way to get in contact with us is through Facebook, Twitter, or Google+. All three places you can find us with the handle FWThinking. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.